Okay, everybody. Welcome to the third episode. This is Pearls of Wisdom. I'm Melissa Peskin, and I am so happy to be here with my two buddies from residency, Dr. Demetrius Woods and Dr. Jitsen Chang, or Jay Chang. I don't know. Somehow in the last several years it changed, so I don't know. But I am just really thrilled to be reuniting with these guys. And I guess let me just let them introduce themselves and we'll go from there. So, Dee, tell me about you. How did you come to Einstein? And what are you up to now?
So I came to Einstein from Emory School of Medicine in Atlanta. And at the time I wanted to come to New York for residency. So I applied to a lot of the New York programs and Einstein was the one that I thought was a good fit for me. And after leaving Einstein, I came back to Atlanta. I worked at Emory for 5 years as an academic OBGYN faculty member. And then I transitioned into a role as a hospitalist here in Atlanta. And that's what I've been doing since then.
Yeah, you left out a lot. That's the PG version. So, anyway, or the
There's a lot
G.
to unpack.
Yeah, it was a lot that got glossed over, but that's okay.
Yeah,
And
maybe. Kind of things.
Jitsen.
I went to medical school at the University of Texas Southwestern in Dallas. I applied to residency. I did not match. I scrambled in to Albert Einstein College of Medicine into the provisional spot, and which was, ranked number one anyway, so it worked out. And then I got to stay at Einstein for a second year after Dr. Flynn, I think, transferred into ER. Is that right? I'm
Family
about
medicine.
family medicine. So I got to stay a second year. And then for a multitude of reasons, I then transferred to Cedars-Sinai for the third and fourth year of residency and finished out in Los Angeles, where I was in private practice for just over 10 years. And then I decided to go full-time into industry and join the company Billion to One to develop their advanced NIPT tests.
You know, it's funny about you, Jitsen, is that even though you were only at Einstein for, I don't know, 2 years, you possibly are one of the most memorable residents that came across, and certainly have maintained relationships and I don't know, with almost everybody, including people who you didn't even do residency with. So kudos to you.
Yeah, one of my legacies is that I was at Cedars, and I think I was an attending at the time. And then we had a sub-I come through our program, who was at Albert Einstein College of Medicine, doing her sub-I's and wanted to match into OB. And so she was on labor and delivery, and she met me, and she was like, "Oh my God, you're Jitsen?" I'm like, "Yeah, I'm Jitsen." She's like, "Did you go to Einstein?" I was like, "Yeah, I went to Einstein for the first 2 years of residency." And she goes, "Oh my God, we still use your login to get into the fetal monitoring strips," because I was like the only one who bothered to set a username and password. And then like everybody used my username and password long after I had left the program. It's probably an IT violation, but that
Don't
was
know.
my legacy.
I remember using Trent's password for something. Was it ASOBGYN or something like that?
Maybe.
I
This
feel
was like
like,
when we first got that central monitoring
yeah, I feel
fetal.
like we shared a lot of passwords. No.
Yeah, because we were all family.
We're a family. Right, Demetrius?
Yeah, that's how I feel. Jitson's practically my cousin.
Well, now, how did you feel back then? Actually, can you tell us a little more about your transition to the Bronx?
A lot of this I've actually blocked out because of my PTSD, and it's taken a long time to repress a lot of these memories, but I'll do my best.
Pandora's box. Let's see.
Yeah, so let's see what I can piece together. First, I chose New York because at the time I was dating someone and I was in like a long distance relationship, that person that moved to New York. And I'll tell this as like a cautionary tale for people out there. Don't follow anybody for any reason ever. That person moved to New York. I ended up actually breaking up with that person after a 3 year relationship the day before residency started. So that was kind of the start of residency for me.
And I
Can I
didn't realize.
interject for one
Yeah,
second?
yeah.
Because what is very special about the first day of residency for you?
Oh, my birthday is July 1st.
Right.
Yeah.
So that was cold
Yeah.
and significant. Okay.
And I had to kind of scramble to find a place to live. And so I, because we were going to live together and then that wasn't going to work out. And so I ended up finding an apartment without actually getting a chance to see it. And it turned out to be in maybe the worst neighborhood in the Bronx, a place that HBO made a documentary about years ago called Hookers from the Point, which is notorious for like prostitution, drugs. I lived in a building where there was regularly like pharmaceutical sales going on in the parking lot, all types of day or night, which was nice because whenever you came home, you had somebody to talk to because you could walk by and like wave at people. A lot of regulars out there. Yeah, that was my introduction to the Bronx. I also come from a not a small southern town, but a very southern town, and had never really experienced the Northeast in that way, other than having done a sub-I at one of the programs in New York.
I remember you said that people were so confused by your suit and tie or your shirt and tie at Story Avenue, right? That's where you live, Story Avenue.
Oh yeah, Story Avenue. Oh, and I will say that after towards the end of my first year, my intern year, I was offered a spot in the hospital's housing, so I didn't have to stay there the whole 4 years. And the hospital's housing was really nice, had a great view and everything. And I lived in the same building as you at the time.
That's right.
I would go to the grocery store on clinic days, and I'd be wearing my shirt and tie, and people would come up to me and ask me where things were, because anytime someone was in that grocery store wearing a shirt and tie, they must be the manager of the grocery store. And I would re just repeat, I don't work here, but the grapes are over there.
You're always so helpful.
Try to be.
I don't know. Jitsen, where did you live?
I kind of went through a similar cultural shock where I grew up in Amarillo, Texas, a town of like 160,000 people, and I would say I want to go explore the big city, and they're like, "This is the big city," and I was like, "No, I think there's bigger cities." And then I went to college in Austin, then Dallas, and slowly got bigger, and then went to the New York, and that's where I just kind of drove up there and found housing on the way, just calling places on Craigslist and rented out a bedroom right down the street from Jacobia and Weiler, and from a nice family. And I had a roommate up there. He was like a classic gym tan laundry like Jersey guy who all he did was work out and tan and go to the gym. So it was a very interesting to have that guy as a roommate as well.
That was
But
for
I
4
say the
years you had that?
yeah.
I don't think I knew that. 4 years you did that. Are you still in touch with
Yeah,
him?
my car got broken into, I think, 12 times in 2 years.
I have so many car stories.
Well, your
So,
car stolen, right?
yeah, my car was stolen. And when they found it running idle in Queens, it was filled to the brim with White Castle trash. And instead of my spare tire in the trunk, there was a cinder block. And that was the time it was stolen. Every other time it was towed, regardless of our, I don't know, of that placard that we had. I can't tell you how many times it was towed. And one time I took a oh, this is great. I remember I was an intern and Kathleen was our chief. And it was winter, and I took a car service, not the car service, that's what it's called. So I jump in the car service, and we get on Pelham Parkway, and the police pull us over, and he's like, "Ma'am, you have to get out." And I was so close to the hospital, but so far away, right? And I had to, and it was slush outside. It was snowing. It was awful. And he's like, "Ma'am, the car you're in doesn't have a medallion." And I was like, "No, sir. I have to be at the hospital." I was freaking out, and he refused to give me a ride. So I remember like sobbing and calling, the labor floor, begging them for forgiveness as I trudged through the snow and slush to get to the hospital on time because they kicked me out of the car service. I was like, "Who cares? I'm a medallion. He was taking me." Bronx
It was
is
unacceptable.
I don't my only car stories are from visiting friends in Manhattan. I had friends from college who lived in New York at the time, but they lived in the city. And the only times I get my car towed would when I would go and visit them and then park and then sleep in their places and forget to get up and move the car. But nothing ever happened to my car in the Bronx.
Well, that's fortunate.
Yeah.
Do you
It was
remember?
not a very nice car. Oh, can I tell the story about the first time I flew home? So I flew home from LaGuardia and I didn't know nowhere to park and I didn't want to pay for like the long-term parking. So I got there and there's this quiet neighborhood kind of like across the street from LaGuardia. So I thought, oh, I'll just leave my car there. And so I drove to LaGuardia and parked my car on the street and I was going home, I think for like 4 or 5 days. Here's the crazy part. I get back and as soon as I did it, I got on. I was like, maybe that wasn't a great idea. I get back, nothing has happened to the car. The car's fine. It's in the same place. Somebody's broken into it. Nobody's touched it. And I got in it and I drove back to my apartment. I'd never did that again while I was in New York, but I just got very lucky. I parked on the street in this neighborhood near LaGuardia and the car was fine and it was there when I came back.
Yeah, that definitely would not have happened to me. My car luck is atrocious. But I never got into bad accidents like other people. I think Javi got into a bad accident, like her bumper. There was a picture of like her bumper had completely fallen off, right? And she put it into the back seat of the car because like she needed to reattach it. God, we were so
Yeah,
broke.
Louis Lowe fell asleep driving up the west, what is it, the West Side Highway,
Right.
whatever. Yeah, driving, fell asleep, crashing in the median and totaled his car. Yeah, there's a lot of scary stuff there for sure.
I think we were run so ragged, right?
Yeah, that
Yeah,
was
that's why I
before
put on
workout
work hour
restrictions.
violations.
Well, no, I think work hour violations were there. They just, no one cared about it.
No, they didn't apply to us. It was the class after us where work hour restrictions actually started.
Oh, I don't think
Yeah.
I realized that. I don't know. I just put my head down and cried almost every day and
There was a lot of crying in our program.
I remember signing up to a knot and we were both just like streaming. The tears just streaming. We couldn't even understand one another. We're signing out like sometime in second year, like Ankh.
You're not really selling this program, Melissa.
Not supposed to sell the program. This is about how we survived. What I frequently recall was like a tremendous, like, extraordinary learning experience, and one that I absolutely adore and love and am grateful for. I mean, you know, for lack of a better analogy, I mean, Einstein's in my blood. Like it will has forever altered my DNA. I mean, it's one of the most cherished experiences, but it was extremely brutal at times, you know, and I feel like we have a shared trauma, which is sort of why I thought that coming together to talk about maybe one of the hardest programs in the country, I think, given the patient population and the where we were, and certainly the size of our program and the demands that were made upon us. I think we can have like a lot of lessons, maybe to share with people. I don't know. And so, what is your most memorable thing about residency?
I guess in a general sense was probably the learning curve, and how quickly you had to go from being an intern who didn't really know how to do anything to a machine that functioned 110 hours a week and had to do everything. And a lot of the roles that we served as residents, I didn't know that residents served those roles because coming from where I had a medical school, residents were just required to see patients, write notes, but we were everything. We were like patient transport. We were the IV team. We were cleanup sometimes. We were social workers. Like that, I didn't, no one had prepared you for any of that in medical school. And it was so much more than just the medical knowledge that you needed to survive in that program that I think that having to learn how to do all of those different things and then still deliver great patient care was the hardest part.
I was just in NYU giving a presentation, and Dr. Hai Hyo was there, as well as Shilpi Mehta and Mehta Lee, and one of the MFM faculties was one of my interns that I trained at Cedars. So it's like two worlds that knew me at two different points of my training. And I opened up the presentation with the fact that, at Einstein, we were trained to do the impossible. Quite literally, day one, I learned how to discharge someone home who was homeless.
Yeah,
And I
wow.
think that sums it up.
Yeah. I don't know how often you got to work with Tamar, but Tamar was sort of one of these people who really took the social aspect of our job to the next level. Every single ER consult was supposed to be a learning experience and an opportunity to allow the patient to finally open up about her past trauma. And damn be the 20 other things you have to do. You're going to sit there and let her open up to you because this is her only opportunity to confess all the people who like hurt her. And you needed to sit there. And even if you couldn't fix it, you were going to be her sounding board. And, being able to be that person for, all of these vulnerable people really changes you.
Yeah, when I was at Cedars, I used to ask people, I was like, okay, do you have food in your refrigerator? And people were like, why do you keep asking everyone that? I was like, oh yeah, sorry. In the Bronx, you had to.
Yeah, there was a lot.
Otherwise, I'll be back for dinner.
I had a pretty memorable experience with a patient, and going along with what you were saying, getting them to open up and talk about their trauma. I think I was on the GYN service. She'd been hospitalized for several weeks. She had just come off of the vent. And it seemed like, everyone was so interested in her medical care that no one was really like finding out how she was feeling. And I thought that I was going to be the one to do that. And so it's maybe 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. And I go in and I talk to her. And I was like, is there anything I can do for you? After I'd asked her all the medical questions, and she says that she wants me to call someone. And so I happily obliged. And I got out my phone and I held it up, and she put the numbers in, and it starts ringing, and I put it on speaker, and I hold it up to her, and her voice is like very raspy. She can barely talk, and her friend picks up, and she goes, "Muriel, come get me. These motherfuckers are trying to kill me." And then I just held the phone there. So she went off for a couple of minutes on how the care was horrible and we were trying to kill her. And then when she was done, I was like, is there anything else? She just kind of gives me this frown and I hung up the phone.
Yeah, I felt like we went spelunking, like in their wounds, They don't do that anymore because people don't have as many open procedures, but we had, like everybody had a massive wound separation. Do you remember?
Yeah.
A lot of hospitals have wound care teams that specifically manage like what to dry, vacuum, all that stuff. Whereas, like, Demetrius was saying, we were everything, everything. Like, we did everything. There was no lift team. Like, we were the lift team.
I just remember that we all developed relationships with the same patients because they would be in the hospital so long and we'd be on call and we'd know these patients, all of us,
Oh yeah, husband, we would know, their two kids. We would just see them like slowly watching their moms die, like on, inpatient services. It was tough. Yeah, you did know everything about all these people. It was really tough.
Sometimes you'd see them in the community. I mean, I live right across the street from one of the hospitals. So some of the patients I'd take care of, I would see through the rest of residency on their little motorized scooters going up and down the sidewalks or in the grocery store.
Really? When you were at Moses?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I don't know that I
Yeah, I
ever.
would see patients in my neighborhood too, because I was like just a few blocks from Jacoby. So I would see them at the, Mercados and stuff, the lavanderias, panenderias in the neighborhood. And it was interesting because people would recognize me or think they re would recognize me, like, you delivered this baby. And I'm like, maybe it was one of the other Asian people. I don't know. But there's a lot of us. We do deliver babies. So it was pretty funny.
You also use that to your advantage.
Oh, all the time. All the time.
You used to tell patients, if you need me, just ask for, Dr. Lee.
Just ask for Ivan. Oh, you're not happy with the care you received? My name is Justin Toe.
What is your earliest memory, or like intern year, I guess, and then compared to the your most memorable at your chief year? Do you have you ever thought about that?
Yeah, I remember day one of intern year, and I was on labor and delivery, and Chris was the chief, and this was like day one, kind of even crazy for Weiler, where things were just busting at the seams, and this patient comes in second stage, pushing like involuntarily, and they rush her back to one of the ORs that's open because all the LDRs are full. So they rushed me back there, and mind you, this was day one. But I had come from Parkland, so I had done deliveries before. That wasn't that big a deal. This was regular multiple vaginal delivery. But Chris Hahn had run out of the LDR to go try to manage the floor, and I ended up doing the delivery like just by myself because I didn't think anything of it. But then she came back in, and she had lost her damn mind that I had done this delivery without any attending, without any chief resident. And I'm just like, listen, I just started about an hour ago. You know what I mean? And I just remember I was like, oh my God, is this how residency is gonna be? Like I thought I'd get a, hey, thank you for covering this delivery and doing the re repair and making sure nobody bled to death and all this stuff because we're busting the seams. There's not enough people to go around. Instead, I just got like absolutely torn to pieces from the top down for not like calling in a chief and an attending for the delivery. And I was like, this is going to be a long residency. And then the last time I saw you guys, I had actually come back for the graduation. So this was, they had the graduation day. So I saw the class 2 years ahead of us. Graduate, and then I'd also come back and saw you guys do your residency research projects and presentations, and it was one of those things where I think Melissa loves this story where Dee does this like mind-blowing presentation that blew the socks off of the entire department about the
Carbon footprint.
about robotic surgery and the carbon footprint, the amount of, I mean, he was like metering the time of the Da Vinci robot was on, how many kilowatts of energy it was burning, all the disposables, the one-time use instruments, and he did it all by himself. And so it was very eye-opening to see like the, just kind of like where we started, where you guys had ended up. I had this unique perspective of having done 2 years at Einstein and 2 years at Cedars. And of course, people at Cedars also think that's a hard, traumatic, difficult residency program, but they have no bar. They have no frame of reference. So that's kind of a very eye-opening experience. For those are the 2 days I definitely remember. And it's just kind of like they say about residency from that song where, the days are long, but the years are short. Because looking back at it, when you're working that hard, it just flies by in the hindsight.
Well, definitely in hindsight. Demetrius, that is one of my favorite stories to tell people. I brag on you all the time. I will never forget the mic drop after you just sort of stopped speaking, and Cindy Shezat and Gary Goldberg, their mouths were on the floor, just like a
That's
gate.
it.
Like,
Blown away.
couldn't believe what you had done. And I mean, because you were so ahead of your time and so brilliant. And I personally didn't think that people recognized your absolute brilliance. And didn't you write something? You wrote a whole play or something like that for the year of
No,
us, right?
Rupi, thank you for your kind words, and you too, Jensen. The one hour. Third years were graduating chiefs. I wrote all of the skits for the dinner, and it's like a roast basically of the chiefs. And it was like a series of like skits about each one. Then there were different parts for each person. So, but that was the
But
only chance I
yeah.
had to like express myself creatively for a while. So I enjoyed
Yeah,
that.
but it highlighted how just brilliant you are, and certainly so did the presentation. And I was super bummed because I had gone to Rwanda and I had done this like huge thing, and I thought I had videos and stuff. And then you come along, and you do this like mind-blowing calculation, weighing all of the drapes and like putting it into a calculator and carbon footprint, and man, and you won the award.
Yeah, it was impressive because not only was the study design fantastic, it was very applicable. It was very memorable. Like, I remember going back into practice and doing surgery, and that was always in the back of my mind, like how much waste. And it like really kind of embodied it and made it to real and tangible. And like Melissa said, it wasn't just the hard work, it was like the presentation, the delivery, you're very well spoken. And I still remember to this day there was a slide on your presentation. And mind you, this is what,
2012.
13, something like that, 13
Mm-hmm.
years ago. I still remember you had this slide that was talking about the waste, and a lot of people didn't understand carbon footprint, waste, and kilowatt hours and stuff like that. And these are kind of like abstract terms. They're like, oh yeah, that number's bigger than this number. But then you had done this beautiful slide where you had, because those things are now common day terms, carbon footprint. Back 13 years ago, this is not such a relatable issue. And you have had this slide where you're like, well, let's say this is, this is an open surgery, this is laparoscopy, this is a da Vinci, and you had these like infographics where it was like one car puttering out smoke. But then the Da Vinci was like this, like the equivalent of like three F SUVs going down the highway, blowing smoke. And I still remember that graphic to this day. I'm like, that really kind of made it relatable, right? Everybody knows back there, 13 years ago, it was all about like, gas efficiency, burning gas, pollution, smog. And so you put it into very relatable terms for everybody in that audience. And we're talking, this is like 600 people. So this is not a small audience either. And these are some of the most critical people I've ever seen at any department that nitpick every little thing, and then you had just blown them all away,
Yeah, they were
and it was
silent. They were speechless.
awesome.
They're usually piranhas.
I came all the way back to New York for it.
Yeah, it was dope. That was great. And the party was fun afterwards, too.
Yeah, it was a great party. That was definitely my most memorable moment from my chief year.
We wrote, right? We wrote everything. I've wrote written like, the Library of Congress worth of notes, right? And I wrote a note one morning on Ankh as an intern that a patient had a tender abdomen with rebound and guarding. And she did. She was very sick and she was extremely tender. And the Ankh fellow, who was extremely scary and never hesitated to throw people under the bus, and I was one of them, she said, pointed to you. And remember, you're a little intern and in front of everybody. Are you going to take this patient to the OR? And you're like, me go to the OR? No. Then why would you ever write somebody had rebound and guarding? And she proceeded to take my note and tear it up and throw it. Yeah, that happened. I was so humiliated. I never wanted to see the light of day again. That was awful. Is this a venting session? There were really great things
Figure
about
out who the fellow was.
Don't worry about it.
I have a pretty good
Oh yeah,
guess.
we can't, I guess we can't throw people under the bus in this.
No, I don't. This is pretty public, so.
Yeah.
But yeah. So there
Yeah,
were
what
really,
I want.
really good things that happened and really funny things. And I think we every time we got together, we would share stories, right? And that was pretty cathartic, and laugh.
Yeah,
So.
and there were plenty of good people that like made it manageable and tolerable. And so those people do deserve a shout out and credit for
Go
that,
for it.
because for your intern year with your third years or even your chiefs, they can be your lifeline. Whereas, some of the second years would just could totally tear you up because they couldn't wait to not be interns and to, rip somebody else out a new one for a change. So, but there were a lot of people that just close to this day, because they taught us so much, and they got us through residency and got us through tough spots, and taught us how to navigate the system and to develop an EQ and which attendings to watch out for, da 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 da. So, I mean, there are good people there too, but it is a bell curve. For every person above the mean, there is one person under the mean, you know?
Yeah, I would totally agree with that. I think there's people that, I would say saved my life. Like, they're the reason that I was able to continue through the program because they were, just like you said, above the curve in terms of their EQ and their willingness to teach and have empathy and, treated us like human beings. I'm very grateful to those people. And I made a point of reaching out to all of them, even after my training was finished, to tell them how much they meant to me and how vital they were in me being able to make it through. So, yeah, I think that's a great point.
I definitely saw a change in you, and certainly you just seemed like sort of a different person by the end. Much happier. We got closer as friends, and I think like leaned on each other. But certainly, I'll never forget my third and fourth years when I was a junior, because for the same reason, as hard as many of them were, there were others that were just so supportive and intelligent and wise and comforting and helpful. To help, guide you and help you grow too. I hope I was like that for other people. I know I was told I was intimidating, but
No, never that.
no.
I will
Yeah.
say that I think that work hour restrictions, as much as we may have resented that because it didn't apply to us in the beginning, but we saw it applying to people after us, that I think it was the best thing that could have happened to training. Putting limits on what you can demand of people really helps their education, and it helps patient care, it helps safety. And I'm a big advocate now for residents not being burned out and residents, using the extra time that they have to be able to learn and to take time for themselves personally. And I think that that is what made it easier for us as seniors to be good seniors for our juniors and to help them to learn and be good doctors because they didn't have to be in the hospital. They weren't constantly exhausted. They had time for, a personal life. And I think that even now, teaching residents, I think that that's important. The residents I teach are, I don't want to call them like bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, but they are more attentive. They are more balanced, and I think that makes them better trainees and ultimately better doctors.
When we were interns, we had to come in and do postpartum rounds before sign up. And that was like a 5 a.m. kind of show up. Remember when we used to joke about Jacoby's postpartum floor being full? We'd say the flight pattern is full. And so we'd have to call the oncoming intern to help you round like at 5 a.m. and see all of them. We're talking about 22 rooms. I'm pretty sure it's still 22 rooms, is like, I still remember it's 22 rooms. And I think they were all doubled up. And I think one room had four people in it, or two rooms had four people in it, right? So it was a lot of patients to round on. Like in when the flight deck was full, and it was awful, and you had to use that awful Jacobi EMR system where it was like not a graphic user interface. You had to like use like hotkeys to like tabulate through different fields and write your notes. And yeah, it already made a difficult process even more difficult and challenging and longer and more inefficient. Yeah, it was awful.
I definitely feel like there were some earlier than 5 a.m. mornings also.
Definitely. Yeah.
On Ankh, my God. Ankh, you might as well not go home.
No, don't. And in fact, many patients would be like, "You're still here?" And no, I went home, but yes, I am back. Yeah.
Ankh was
Happened a
challenging
lot.
because before sign out, you had to come on at like 4 or 5 in the morning and do all the H&Ps for the chemo admits
That's
before
right.
sign out.
That's
Remember?
right.
Yeah. And even though we had a big binder to like kind of copy the admission note H&P beforehand, it still took forever. It was all handwritten notes. It was, there was no chemo infusion center. There was no chemo nurses. It was just you. You had to do everything. It was, I had to write all the goddamn chemos.
I think I blocked that out. That was awful.
Guys definitely blocked that out. I went to Cedars and we had chemo infusion center. Never saw patients for chemo as an inpatient. That was crazy.
Do you guys
Routine.
remember having to pre-op onc patients and having to consent them for surgeries, these crazy long surgeries that you would never even get into? You'll get your omentectomy and your lymphadenectomy, and we'll stage you. And you remember we had to go into those rooms and consent everybody
Yeah,
before
we
the
had the
concert?
we Dr. So-and-so special, remember?
Yeah.
Like, oh, just got the abdominal pain. We'll take care of everything. And then the intern goes and like consents them for like staging in the next hour. Oh, it's like crazy to get it all paid for by Medicaid. It was like, oh, they came in with an acute abdomen, and so we staged her for this stage three ovarian cancer.
To make a lot of concessions. I mean, these are the most vulnerable patients in the country, you know? And one of the one things I will say, because having gone to a different hospital where you do have to, you know, the payer mix is definitely different, is that we actually, I feel like, could practice, had the sort of latitude to practice really strong evidence-based medicine that counted and that wasn't sort of confined to what most other hospitals had to do in order to justify the payer or the insurer. Like, we could just practice evidence-based medicine that benefited the patient, even if it meant like social admissions and someone wanted to stay for days, weeks. You know, we did that. I mean, I liked that. I know that's not reality, but I liked that.
No, you make an excellent point because I think that actually affected my career choice thus far. Right now as a hospitalist, I kind of have the latitude that we had as residents in the Bronx, which is that if somebody needs something done, we can do it. I don't have to call and get a pre-certification from an insurer. If somebody comes in with blood in their belly from ruptured ectopic or has a big cyst and abdominal pain and it needs to come out, I can do it then. Admitting people for things that, you don't I don't have to call and get a pre-authorization for is part of the appeal, I think, of being a hospitalist is that you can do whatever needs to be done at that moment. And that was something that in private, even private academic practice, you just couldn't do. So.
I mean, even as much as like getting endometrial biopsies for everybody with, you know, postmenopausal bleeding, right? Every single patient got an endometrial biopsy no matter what. And when I went to a different hospital, nobody got EMBs. They would send everybody to the clinic. And I just was so confused, scratching my head. They're right here. How, what if they don't come back? You know, that kind of mentality was ingrained in me. It really
Yeah,
shaped
the ER was a clinic and it functioned as a clinic. And that's the outpatient care was the ER. And so, yeah, people, I mean, I remember doing pap smears on in the ER on some patients that had a history of dysplasia. And then you had to like put them in a binder and follow up with the path results and make sure you had a good follow-up information for that patient and then say, hey, you need a LEAP, time to come back to the ER.
I once took a picture of the Moses ER because it had so many people in it. And Trent is so short. So I was looking for him. It was like a Where's Waldo thing. And I caught an image and it was like he was looking for the patient. Mrs. Smith, Mrs. Smith, where are you? It was just like this crazy thing where he was lost and she was lost. And then it was like Tetris. In order to get the patient to the GYN room, you had to move the beds of all these other people, like move them through.
Yeah, to make a path to get out of the gridlock. I remember that.
Place
Yeah, I
was
remember like because that ER was nuts. It was like, okay, they're on the north wall, they're on the east wall, they're on the west wall. You know, like that was the only direction you got. And I remember seeing this one consult. And remember, keep in mind, I think we're second years. We're at Moses. We're by ourselves, right? You can only call in the attending if there's like a surgical emergency. Otherwise, you're completely by yourself. And so I get this like consult, I go over there, they're like, oh, they're on the west wall or whatever. And there's like 80 people against the west wall. And I'm like, all right, I'm looking for a Ms. Hernandez. Like four people raise their hand. I was like, Maria Hernandez. Two people put their hands down. I'm like, born in
Oh,
64. Bingo, there's my patient. Like, what the hell is going on?
and remember how NCB, so Moses didn't have a labor floor. So if anybody came in with an obstetric emergency, we had to determine whether they needed immediate OB care as a second year, right? Or could you call for transport to Weiler, or did you have to take them to NCB? And NCB didn't want us. They would like lock the doors and prevent us from going. Jensen, didn't you have someone who was like a breech pre-prom, like preterm?
Yeah, so I have two cases I remember. One where I still remember the attending too, so I won't say her name, but I called her. This was a patient who was 39 years old. And she came in. This was a crazy story because she woke up, she was seeing double. So she went to the ophthalmology walk-in clinic. She waited there like 3 hours. They do an intake, take her blood pressure. It was like 200 over 160. So they send her to the ER. There she sits for 2 hours to manage her as essential hypertension. Her repeat blood pressure is like 240 over 180. And then they call me. They're like, "Hey, we can't get this patient's like blood pressure down. Is it possible to have like HELLP syndrome in the first trimester?" I'm like, "I've never heard of that." And then I was like, "Is she pregnant?" They're like, "Yeah, we did the beta HCG. Her beta is like 4,000. So we'll have to rule out ectopic at some point. But we need to get her blood pressures down. But her liver enzymes are in the thousands. Her platelets are like 7 or 8." I'm like, "I'm very confused about this." But so they said that they were going to get the blood pressures down, and I had told them, I was like, "Well, try hydralazine. Hydralazine is kind of like what we go to once the, IV pushes stop working." And then I went to labor and I went to the ER just to kind of eyeball her. I was like, "Hey, I know they're treating you for all these things and trying to get your blood pressure down and see what's going on with your liver and your platelets, but I just wanted to like do a quick bedside ultrasound." And I do an ultrasound, and she has a 32-week IUFD in her belly. And I'm like, "Oh, you're pregnant. You're about 8 months pregnant based on my ultrasound." And she goes, "No, that's impossible. I was told like 5 years ago I have PCOS. I can never get pregnant." So she had no idea she was pregnant. It was full IUFD. She ended up having a head MRI. She had bilateral retinal detachments from the high blood pressure. She didn't have a stroke, but she was in full-blown HELLP. Her platelets were, like I said, single digits. LFTs in the thousands, and I tried to transfer to NCB for the magnesium, whatever. And it was fun. I still remember the ER is like, "Don't worry, we already gave her the mag. She's so you don't have to worry about a seizure." And they like hung 2 grams of mag IV bolus, no loading, no main, nothing. There was like 2 grams of mags in, we're good. And so I tried to transfer to NCB, and they're like, "No, there's nothing we can do for her here." I was like, "Really? You're not going to take this patient?" So I had to ride in the ambulance with the patient all the way to Weiler, in case she had a seizure. Not that I can do anything about a seizure in an ambulance, And then I went back, but then the one that finally made it past the iron doors that you described between the connecting the two buildings was the 26-week PPROM footling breach. And then they were very like the. "Okay, fine, we'll take her, but you're gonna assist her in the surgery." I'm like, "Oh, fine." I was like, iron doors, they would not let you in for anything. Like the baby's foot had to be out of the vagina for them to take the patient. Otherwise, you were on your own.
You were, you really were. What about you, D?
It's really difficult for me to remember anything from residency, other than the, I guess, the stuff that I learned.
What sticks out in your head? Like I had, questions, what's the craziest story? What was the biggest lesson you learned? What was the earliest lesson? I don't know, things that maybe really stuck with you, but it sounds like you did a lot of healing and walking.
I guess for better or for worse, yeah, I did. I think that I used to tell residency stories out after I finished residency to some of my residents when I was at Emory and even in my current position at Wellstar. And I stopped because a lot of them were, to me, they were like funny, but to this generation of trainees, it's just like unresolved trauma. It's like, no, that's not funny at all. Like that's horrible that that happened to you. And so now I don't tell any of those stories. I don't even talk that much about residency other than the things that I learned, the clinical pearls, like the different cases that that kind of stick out, I guess.
Okay, so what was one of those?
Think even that is hard now. Let's see.
Yeah, if your patient has double vision, you should think HELLP syndrome, 32-week IUFD,
Retinal
top of the
detachment. I had a case like that. I talk about my residency stories all the time. Justin and I talk incessantly about our stories. And you again, we're only there for 2 years, so but I find it cathartic. I talk about it all the time, and I know some of it is unresolved trauma, but some of it is also just like the wow factor. I can't believe I saw that. I feel like I've seen everything. I feel like things in the textbook are inadequate to describe the experience that we got in our residency. I remember being an intern and being so in awe of the chief. Because there was a patient who came in with pressures at Jacobi of 220 over 130 or something like that. And you know, she handled it so beautifully as a chief. Like, she just handled it. She knew exactly what to do.
My clinical and teaching style is definitely a product of Einstein because I have a certain way that I do things, and I explain to the residents, here's what I do, here's why I do it. And I'll often joke, I'm not saying that my way is the right way, I'm just saying every other way is the wrong way.
Before Dee goes on, and this kind of reminds me of a scene in that new show, St. Denis, where the nurse basically says the same thing Dee is saying. Let's hear.
This is not the type of job, you know, where if you mess up, it's like, oh gosh, we lost the big account. You know, this is like, if you mess up, it's we took out the wrong organ, you know? So you don't have to do things my way, but you do have to do them the right way, which is, you know, how I do them.
I think that is something that they can take with them. And if you are trying to develop your own clinical style, your own techniques in terms of surgery, it's good to have one way that you know works that you can rely on when you get out of your training. So that if you're in a situation and you're thinking, okay, how can I accomplish this? I can think back to Dr. Woods's way and do it the way Dr. Woods did it. And that is one of the things that I'm always forever grateful for about Einstein is that no matter what situation I'm in, I can think back to how this one person did this and say, all right, I can accomplish this by doing that.
Yeah, I had the same thing. I saw residency as an opportunity to sort of develop my art, and there were very much things that I absolutely loved, and there were also things that I was like, I'm never doing that. And so I would sort of I created my style based on the things that I absolutely loved about certain attending what how certain attendings did things, and then I would like absolutely take other things and say, you know, that attendings did that I really didn't like, and not do that, not incorporate that, and say, okay. This is how I perform my art. But I'm similar. I don't really, I feel like other attendings, especially at NYU, all do things their way. And I'm like the person who does it differently. And so I want them to eventually become decision makers and figure out what they want. But they, like you said, the buffet, like they have to see different ways of doing something to determine which one they prefer. And certainly the one when they see something work, and it always works because we do it really well, they can rely on that when things get tough.
Yeah. A lot of times they're resistant. I'll just use the example of using the Raytec to give traction on the umbilical cord when you're waiting for to deliver the placenta versus using the clamp. And I say, if you do this, you're less likely to avulse the cord. And in the beginning, because they've never seen that before, they're a little resistant to it. By the time they're chiefs, they all want to do it that way.
Do you know why we started using the Raytec? Do you guys remember?
There was, I remember one doc specifically that did it, but now I can't remember her name. But I think that she was at Jacoby.
Judson, do you
Mark
remember
Wheeler?
why? No, it wasn't
No.
Wheeling. Guys, we didn't do that because of any like stylistic thing. We did that because they preserved the placentas and they didn't want to clot off the cord. So they said, yeah, because once they stopped collecting the placentas, the program like expired, everybody went back to at Einstein went back to the clamp.
I remember everyone except for one attending using the clamp.
You're funny.
I was really funny before residency, actually. I was a completely different person.
You died. You said I'm dead inside.
I did. I coined the
Yes, sir.
term dead inside. And then the interns, by the time the interns were using it and I was a chief, it had lost all meaning because they were only working like 80 hours a
Oh
week.
no.
A pretty good quality of life. But no, it was I think it was Sophia, the PA on Ankh. Was she an Ankh PA?
Yeah.
She,
Or
one day I
GYM.
was just having an especially rough day and she was like, "Hey, are you okay? Like, is everything all right?" And I was like, "I mean, yeah, I'm fine. Like, I mean, I'm dead inside, but other than that, I'm good to go." And she just kind of looks at me and couldn't tell if I was joking or not. And I wasn't joking. I definitely felt dead inside. And she was like, "That's not good. That's not good." And I was like, "I'm fine though. I can still work." Like, and then people just started saying it, and then they said it so much that it just lost all meaning. So.
The way that you deliver your comedy or your stories or anything is just with this look in your eye, and you really can't tell until you yourself react after the fact whether you're kidding or not.
When you said, "Oh, come get me. These motherfuckers trying to kill me." Did not see that coming at all. Fucking hilarious. The delivery, spot on.
Man, it was really good reminiscing with my buddies D and Jitsen. I want to thank them so much for coming on and reminiscing with me. Even though Demetrius seems to have blocked out a lot of residency, I can always count on Jitsen to remember every detail, every person's name, every minutia of that time period, as it meant the world to me. And it seems that we forged a ton of friendships and relationships that, are lasting and really will go on and on again because we have this shared experience or possibly shared trauma. I will say one thing about Einstein is that we are everywhere, every state, every city, it seems, even different countries. And so no matter where you go, you're bound to meet somebody who has the Bronx and Einstein in their blood. All right, well, I want to thank you so much again for listening. Until next time, bye.